Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. 30 years ago, Anita Hill faced down an all-male, all-white Senate Judiciary Committee, led by then-Senator Joe Biden, to testify that her boss, Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas, had sexually harassed her. It was a landmark moment for these issues and inspired countless women to come forward with their stories, to file complaints, and even to run for public office. In her new book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, Hill draws on her decades as a teacher and legal scholar to explore the far-reaching impact of gender-based violence, why it persists, and what we can do to protect future generations. Dr. Anita Hill is University Professor of Social Policy, Law, and Women's and Gender Studies at Brandeis University. Her new book is Believing, and it's a great pleasure and honor to welcome Anita Hill to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for allowing me to be on your show.
Well, you are someone that we've wanted to talk to for a long time, and this book is so important and really so powerful. I want to start with just the title of the words that you use of ending gender violence, which I thought was really an interesting and important choice because that covers non-binary people. That covers men in addition to women. And the violence obviously includes anything from rape to intimate partner violence to stalking to harassment. That's a very intentional choice of words.
It absolutely is. And it's intentional because I really want to honor the people who have approached me with their problems. Not all of them were sexual harassment. There were stories about bullying in schools and sexual assault among elementary school children. There's stories about intimate partner violence, stalking. And of course, there were stories about rape and sexual assault that came to me. And even though I had expected to hear mostly from women, I heard from a number of men who had their stories of violations that were raised, sexual, some of them in nature, but others were just violent behavior addressed that they had to experience or have experienced because maybe of the way that they express their gender or their sexual identity. And I wanted to be inclusive. I wanted to be inclusive, and I wanted to honor people's experiences.
As you write about this subject, the enormity of it, the breadth of these interconnected problems, which you write about so brilliantly, of how they are interconnected, the term you use is boiling the ocean. That's a great way to describe it, and it shows just how complex it is.
How complex it is, and I think in ways it shows how hard it is to resolve and why people have been so resistant to just taking it on, because it is a huge problem, and it is complex. And unfortunately, I think many people want simple answers to the problem. And those just will not work. We're always going to be like, sticking our finger into the dike to keep the floods from happening if we take that approach. And so I want us to look at the holes that are in the structure, the entire structure, so that we can start to really see some progress toward the end. And I say ending gender violence because this book is, I realize, aspirational. I mean, there is no, and I know it's not going to be done instantly. There's no one shot or one book that is going to cure it. But we can begin if we start to look at not only the behaviors that we're experiencing, but also look at the cultures and the cultural myths in large part that support the behaviors and provide cover for the behavior, as well as the processes that are meant to stop the behavior that are failing woefully.
You write toward the beginning of the book, we must acknowledge that gender violence is systemic and accept that the familiar solutions we've been offered to end the scourge are inadequate. They are inadequate. Are they stepping stones?
They're starts, and there are pieces of some processes now that have been developing that are helpful. But structural changes are in order, and those I think are just the hardest to come by because it takes concerted effort from leadership to ensure structural changes. And it takes humans to change the way they think and act toward victims to change culture.
You are a rare person. I was thinking of this as I was reading the book. You're a rare person who had one day change the entire course of their life. And while accidents happen, you volunteered for this and said, I'm going to come forward. And obviously you'd have no idea that 30 years later, we would still be talking about these issues, and this would become your life's work.
I had no idea, and initially, even returning home after the hearing, I had no intention of this becoming my life's work. But what I didn't take into account, because I just had no way of knowing that it would happen, was that I would hear from so many people who had compelling stories and accounts. And those really shaped my thinking. I remember very early on, and it was a little almost frightening because I knew at the moment that I hung up from this one call that I was not going to be able to see my experience in the same light ever again. And it was a call that I received in my office from a man. Like I said, I expected to hear from women to talk about sexual harassment, but this was a man who talked about his experience with incest. And he opened the conversation saying, "You've opened to me. You have opened a whole can of worms." And I wasn't sure exactly what he meant, but he went on to explain about his experience trying to tell his parents about the incest that he was experiencing and being rejected by them, and his parents taking the side of the man who was his abuser. And I listened to it, and he went on to say that the hearing reminded him of his parents and those people who had denied and dismissed his complaint. And he said that he was not going to be the only call like that I received, that there would be others as well. And that maybe the behavior wouldn't be incest, but that what he got from watching the hearing was that there were many victims and survivors of abuse that were feeling the same way about being dismissed and being rejected that I was feeling after I testified. And so it occurred to me, first of all, that I wasn't alone, and that the problem was bigger than sexual harassment.
You write in the book about that dismissal, and the dismissal that gentleman writing to you was talking about. And you write about Senator Arlen Specter of in retrospect making an assertion that Clarence Thomas's behavior wasn't too bad and that it was expected, that if you were talking about the size of breasts that was expected. That was not out of the ordinary. And yet you had to be sitting there saying, well, no, right? I mean, it has to be an unbelievable feeling to keep your composure, knowing as you look at this older all-white panel that your beliefs and their beliefs are very different.
And I now understand that whether or not Senator Spector believed that it wasn't that bad, that, you know, I had to listen to my immediate supervisor not only press me for dates, but also talk about his enjoyment of pornography in the workplace when I'm really just trying to do my job, that wasn't that bad. I'm not sure that he thought that it wasn't so bad, but I think it was a tactic. It was a tactic to tell me and other women and men and people who don't identify as either male or female that this kind of behavior, if you describe that we don't have to take it seriously, that we can dismiss it no matter what it is. We can dismiss it because we have the power to dismiss it and to deny your reality and substitute our own. And so I've since talked to, and one person even told me they did a social experiment in their workplace, and they asked, after reading the book, they asked people, have you heard this phrase? And every woman in the office in this particular place had heard this phrase over and over again. And it is effective language. It causes us to doubt ourselves, to doubt our importance and the significance of our harm to us. And it also says that, you know, the world doesn't have any responsibility to stop it. And that's why I think we have to act on how these cultural presumptions about the harm that these problems are causing individually and collectively to us. And we have to accept that people in power have the responsibility to do something about it and not to act in denial or dismissiveness when we report it to them.
Anita Hill is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. I want to just hit on two historical points. You have several in the book, but two that I really found interesting. First of all, wow, was I surprised that Red Book was the media outlet that held the first national survey on sexual harassment in 1976. That's extraordinary.
Yes, it is. And it is telling, too, about how even in this period when women were going into the workplace in bigger numbers, nobody thought this was an important enough issue to address. Nobody in our government was addressing it. Researchers in colleges and universities weren't studying it. And why is that so? I think it's because we didn't value that aspect of their experience, and maybe we even just accepted it as normal. But it's also so because we didn't really have full enforcement of the laws to protect against it. That took a while to come, even after the Red Book publication. But, you know, I invite people to read that because some of the same responses mm. to the survey continue today mm. in terms of people trying to pass off the problem. But we have learned a lot since then. And one of the things that we have learned is that we're not only dealing with the cultural denials, but we're also dealing with systems that deny our experiences and make it even harder for us to overcome structures to get some kind of reckoning and justice for them.
I always love books that give me homework when I read them, and then I read something that I didn't know, and then they allow me to go out and to find out more about subjects and individuals that I had no idea existed. Your book introduced me to an individual who comes off as a real hero in this book, and of course is a real hero, and that is Spotswood Robinson. Give us a brief biographical sketch of him. You write several times about him and the work that he did, which, as you said, during this time, even after Red Book, of as those laws started to be put into place up until even, say, 91, when you testified, of how things were changing.
Right. Well, first of all, we know that Catherine MacKinnon was the architect of the whole concept of sexual harassment being a violation of one's civil rights. But then it had to go to the courts to be, and there had to be complaints filed based on the theory, and then the theory had to be accepted as law. Well, there were a slew of cases in the late 70s, and in most of the very early cases, the judges who decided them just said simply, this is not something that the law protects against. This is just something that happens naturally when you put women and men together, and there's no reason for us to be looking at this as a civil rights violation. Spotswood Robinson came along, and he decided some very important cases. He was a district court judge in the District of Columbia federal court system. He was also a court of appeal judge in the same circuit, and so the D.C. Circuit. So he came into judging after years of teaching, as well as years of representing Black plaintiffs in race cases. And he was able to shore up the arguments and protections against sexual harassment by making analogy to racial harassment, if you will, and racial slurs and limitations that were put on people in the workplaces. And he said that, and, you know, the law had intended to protect women from biased behavior that was aimed at them because they were women, in the same way that the law was there to protect people of color and all people from racial bias that was reflected in their workplaces. And that connection hadn't been made. All of the other judges were sort of assuming that the problem was, you know, something kind of nature, that men were naturally inclined to abuse women, and that was acceptable. And Robinson said, that's no more acceptable than a white person abusing a Black person because of their race and telling them that they can't have a certain job or that they can only do certain kinds of work or that they are only fit to do menial tasks. And so this was really a breakthrough in terms of attaching to the law to the real lived experiences of women in the workplace, and that's how we ultimately got a Supreme Court decision that ruled that in fact sexual harassment was a violation of a woman's civil rights.
Did you ever have the opportunity to talk to him about your case?
I never met him. I've been talking to different people who were closer to his age, and there are those people who knew him or knew of him as a professor or as a judge. Right. But what I do think is that what was so important about his experience was that he had experience representing oppressed people. And he understood that oppression has many faces and that sexual harassment was one of them. He was a great thinker. And that was how we were able to be where we are today with the protections that are in place.
Your book is explicit about those forces of racism and misogyny and how they are interlinked and how difficult it is to pull them apart, especially when you're trying to solve the root problems?
Yes, it is difficult. It's complex. There's not going to be a simple answer. But we've got to start, first of all, by looking at the whole problem. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book. And I think people will be able to see the connections if I follow people, what happened in the elementary school, and then high schools, and then colleges and universities, and then workplaces. Then you start to see the threads of the problem and how, you know, we can work and look at it as a whole problem. I think that's critical, because then we can get our leaders to acknowledge that this is a significant and real problem, and that it has public impact. It has reached a crisis level when you start to look at the numbers that show how prevalent it is. We need to do, once we acknowledge, we need to get more information, because we don't even now have information to measure what the economic impact of sexual harassment is in our workplaces. We, you know, there were four senators, Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, Dianne Feinstein, and Patty Murray, who asked for information from the government about the impact of sexual harassment on the economy. And the answer that they got really was that we don't have that information collected. We know that there's psychological harm. We know that there's physical harm that's caused. We know that it costs in lost wages and productivity. We know that it costs in terms of litigation costs. But we haven't put it all together. I think that, you know, it has to be the next step to getting the government to invest in doing the research so that we know exactly what we're dealing with. Because if you can't solve what you don't acknowledge, and you can't solve what you don't measure. And so those are two important steps. And I think it's our government's responsibility to take those steps. We shouldn't leave it, shouldn't have left it to Red Book to start this conversation. And we shouldn't leave it to private organizations at this point to be able to fill in all the gaps for the information we need to come up with solutions.
Anita Hill is our guest. The new book is Believing. So that brings us to Brett Kavanaugh. So I'm curious as to how you watch that case. I know you have met Christine Blasey Ford. I know you did a podcast together and talking about your experiences. But as the two of you look, and obviously you have different journeys, but there are many similarities of the lack of protections that are there and a clear process that can help women go forward in situations that the two of you were put in.
One of the things that I think is just really a national embarrassment is that even today, I don't know of any process that the Senate Judiciary Committee has for receiving a complaint against a nominee, a judicial nominee. We talk about what things can be done. An announcement by the Senate Judiciary Committee that a process has been put in place, that it involves, allows for a full investigation of these complaints. There's a place that you can go to give your complaint. The investigation that will be conducted will be independent. It won't be under the control of the president, who has an interest in seeing their nominee move forward. If we can get that, I think that that is more than symbolic. It is a statement, yes, it is a statement that the country cares about harassment and assault and cares that our voices be heard. But it's also something that needs to be in place to ensure that our courts have integrity and that the integrity of the nominees are being fully vetted. So, you know, we can't undo 1991. We can't undo 2018.
Mm-hmm.
But we can, going forward, make sure that they never happen again in the way that they did in the past two instances.
I mean, one of the things in your book that was a real gut punch to me, you write that three of the past five U.S. presidents have been accused of behavior ranging from rape to sexual assault and unwanted touching. Two current Supreme Court justices accused of sexual assault and harassment. Congressional staff and visitors have filed an unknown number of complaints against U.S. congressmen and senators, and military scandals involving sexual harassment and assault, intimate partner violence, rape, and death are happening with such frequency that it's hard to even keep track. It comes to a point that I think you articulate in the book is that, yes, you have been very patient, but your patience is waning.
And I hope that reading the book, that people will feel that urgency, the same urgency that I feel, because when you look at all of the facts, you cannot help but realize that this is not a problem that's going to go away on its own. And it is a problem that has reached such proportions that it has become a national embarrassment, that somebody needs to take responsibility for it. Somebody with the power to make changes needs to take responsibility for it. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that not that, you know, that there's a gut punch just make people feel the pain, but it also then connects with their hearts and their minds in terms of acting to address the issue, not only for public officials, but for the individuals who are suffering.
Anita Hill's new book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. It is published by Viking. Anita Hill, I can't tell you how much it has meant to me to speak to you and to read your incredibly powerful book and for you to share with our audience. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for some wonderful questions and for reading the book.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.